Thank you for downloading the Start the Week podcast from BBC Radio 4. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. Hello. Reports from various front lines today. Anthony Pagden, political science professor working at the University of California, believes that today's struggle between radical Islam and liberal capitalism is merely the latest episode in a fight between the West and East that's been going on for 2,500 years. The director, Jonathan Kent, has a new musical, Marguerite, set in occupied wartime Paris, a city of moral compromise and corruption. Later we're going to hear about another kind of war, the one against AIDS, from Elizabeth Pisani, journalist and former NGO worker who believes that we all need to hear the wisdom of whores. First, though, the struggle for the future of the human brain. Nanotechnology, increasingly sophisticated drugs, digital culture, neurochips, that's a mingling of brain cells and silicon microchips, all threaten to reshape not just the divine jelly, but our very personalities. Worried or inspired? Susan Greenfield, well-known neuroscientist. Are we standing on a new front line here?
I think we are. And I think it often happens with technologies. They all converge at once. And we're having a convergence of information technology, of nanotechnology and biotechnology. And all these are creating an environment in the 21st century that I think is truly unprecedented. I know that in the past people have looked at improvements like television or the electric light and think, well, this is, you know, going to change our lives. But I think that on a very dramatic basis, these new technologies are invasive and pervasive as never before. And because we have such malleable brains, such malleable minds, that we are going to have to think about how we're going to shape society in the future. And
let's just take a couple of the things that are happening one by one. Nanotechnology, minuscule chemical robots almost inside the brain. Just give us a sense of what's happening.
Okay, nano is, as you say, very small-scale devices where one surface is a billionth of a metre. And this has very interesting repercussions because it can actually change the properties of materials. And it's a bit like explaining to someone in the Middle Ages the impact of plastic and just think how ramifying that is. So even at the very least, if materials around you have different properties, that's going to change the way you see them and the way you see the world and yourself navigating them. My own particular interest, beyond aircraft that will be 50 times lighter and scratchless surfaces and the like, is more the biomedical applications. And because they are so small, these nanotechnological devices, one may be capable of breaching the heretofore firewall between the brain and the body and the outside world. And why I find that interesting is, on the one hand, yes, you'll have early warning devices for certain things going wrong. On the other hand, of course, people have third-party access in a way that they didn't before. And another really exciting...
Sorry, people can access parts of other people's brains.
Well, not quite. There's one very interesting example given by someone called Michio Kaku of you clean your teeth in the bathroom mirror, and the bathroom mirror or the toothbrush says to you, you better watch out, you could lose all your teeth. In 10 years' time, you've got gum disease. And then, somewhat sobered, you then urinate in the lavatory pan. The lavatory pan says to you, you've got diabetes or something. But more relevance to the kind of areas I work on, everyone's thinking, is more the interface with the brain. And already there's some astonishing work at Duke University in the States, which I mentioned in my book, where people who are quadriplegic, that's paralysed from the neck down, by virtue of implants in their brain, which have interfaced with the brain cells, and silicon and carbon can do this. We know that brain cells can actually be quite at home on integrated circuits. That now, astonishingly, a patient can will a prosthetic robotic arm to move. This has also been done in rats who are not paralyzed, but simply prefer just thinking to getting sugar water rather than pressing with their little
paws. So as you say, the firewall between, going back to the old Descartes, division indeed, between the brain and the outside world is breaking down all over.
I think the firewall breaks down in many ways. One is, can you imagine a rather perverted Big Brother where you watch somebody's blood glucose levels go up and down, or watch their gum disease take shape, you know, rather than the people themselves? Rather, but much more relevantly, I think, and very exciting for me, is this final interface between a thought and an action, between the idea and the reality. I find that
again
fascinating.
Let me just take you back to because I think a lot of people would be surprised and possibly alarmed by this. We're all aware of the sense of silicon chips and digital technology as a kind of alternative to human thought. What I hadn't realised was that it was so easy to actually grow human brain cells on silicon chips and combine computer technology with the inner jelly, as it were.
Well, Well, let's unpack that a little bit. Brain cells are brilliant electronic components. They've had the whole of evolution to become that. And there's some work by someone called Peter Fromherz, for example, in Germany, if anyone wants to Google on that, which actually shows how they can be exploited for what he calls neurochips, and you can think of that. But we mustn't confuse that with the notion of conscious machines or pure computation substituting for human brain power, which I don't think it does. As Niels Bohr, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, once said to a student, he said, you're not thinking, you're just being logical. Mm. And there is more to human thought and the human mind and brain than mere, in inverted commas, computational logical processing. And what fascinates me is the role of intuition and common sense and the way that we can make creative leaps, which computers cannot do.
So we have nanotechnology.
We have nanotechnology.
We have the marrying of silicon and human tissue. You've also written a lot, and it's in this new book, but you've said a lot about it before, about the effect of digital culture. That's getting all our culture from fast-moving screens rather than from sentences in books.
As I say in the book, if you think about living in two dimensions, which is what kids nowadays in the West are all spending on average 6 hours a day in front of a screen. And I think this has a lot of ramifications. Now, I don't want to sound alarmist or Luddite, because I think it's up to us to harness the good things of the screen culture and make sure we minimise the threats. So like all technology, it's neither good nor bad. And I really want to stress that. I'm not saying let's put a machete through all computers. You know. But nonetheless, if you think about screen culture, it does mandate various kind of stimuli, for example, visual stimulation, a stimulation that's coming fast and furious. The notion of the abstract word would be harder to display on a screen.
Do you think that somebody who is brought up to read complicated sentences and complicated books is therefore going to have a, inverted commas, better brain than somebody who is simply using screens and computer games?
I would certainly not be arrogant enough to say one had a better brain than someone else, but I think, and I draw a distinction between content and process, and I think that
you are reshaping your brain the whole time.
The brain, and what one has to learn or grasp absolutely at the beginning is your brain is very sensitive to any input that comes in. So if you think about it, when you read a book, you have a beginning, a middle, and end. You go on a journey. The authority takes you by the hand, and it might not be a journey you like, but nonetheless it's one you do, and then you evaluate one journey in terms of the next journey and so on. And for me, that's what education is or used to be. But you get a sense of connectivity. You relate one thing to something else. And gradually, you build up a conceptual framework. And so that conceptual framework enables you, when you then go onto Google, to ask a meaningful question because you're able to place something into a context. Now, imagine you've never done that. Imagine you've had a premium of the boom, bang, a bang, the yuck and wow of the screen, where nothing relates to anything else because you haven't been on a sequential journey.
It's sensationalist in the real sense.
Sensation, yes, and it's sensation rather than cognition. Yeah. Mm. So you're living in a world that's sensory-driven rather than cognitive. And there are some benefits. For example, there's a wonderful book by someone called Stephen Johnson, Everything That Is Bad Is Good For You, where he actually points out that the shift in IQ, for example, that's occurred over the last decades, might be due to a facility with computer games because one is learning certain skills of very rapid pattern recognition and so on.
So there's a lot here. We've only touched some of the issues that you raise in the book, but in essence, what you've written is, it seemed to me, a moral book. It's a book or a philosophical book. Yeah. It's about personality.
Yes.
And you say
yeah.
that there are various possible personalities. Mm. There's the someone personality, yeah. mm-hmm. the no one personality, mm-hmm. and the anyone personality.
Well, I'd rather call them scenarios than personalities. And like all quick labels, they are just that. You know. So, but nonetheless, I think it's a convenient way of contrasting different options by having these easy headings. And very briefly, the no-one scenario is the one that we've just been exploring, where you say yuck and wow, you're in a sensory hedonistic world, you're reacting to stimulation coming in very quickly.
You have a less settled personality of your own.
Yes, it's process rather than meaning. It's process rather than content. You're there responding to sensations rather than placing them into a more extensive narrative.
So the anyone scenario.
Then the anyone scenario is a collective identity, and I'm sure we'll be talking about this in a minute with Anthony, but it's where
we're all good communists, or whatever.
And I would like to stress again, I don't exclusively mean religious fundamentalism, any kind of fundamentalist doctrine, which can be religious, doesn't have to be, where an individual is subsumed under the collective narrative, where what you eat, think, do, act, and so on is actually, I say, in the service of the greater
I'm above
idea.
All a Christian scientist or a British imperial citizen,
exactly.
or whatever it might be.
And of course, an extreme example is when the individual is dispensable. So that's the anyone scenario. And then the someone scenario is the one that we're most used to, is sort of 20th century Western consumerism. Human beings have always wanted to be someone, but I think over the last few centuries that's been enhanced even further as we've had the socioeconomic facility to differentiate ourselves from each other, which coincides, interestingly enough, with the rise of the novel, this notion of an individual and being your own life narrative, your own life story. But you define yourself, literally your status, your standing next to someone else, by what you own or how these things are symbolic. And my own view is that there are certain behaviours, the seven deadly sins are good examples of human nature, which are symbolic. They say something about you. They're not any more biological behaviours, but they are exaggerated out of a biological context in order to be symbolic, to say something about you. And that is the somebody scenario.
Anthony Paglen.
Yes, can I just ask you something about the anyone, which is obviously the one that
interests me most,
which is, and it has something to do with the rapidity with which this process is supposed to happen, which is something I didn't really grasp from your book, that we're not talking about processes over long periods of time, presumably. We're not talking about processes over generations. This is not something to be transmitted genetically.
No, this is not some kind of Lamarckian genetics.
No, exactly. So it's each individual. Now, you're talking in terms not of culture, but of nurture, so to speak. Right? So it's not the question of how long does it take a child to become or a young adult to become inured in such a way to the alternatives that they begin to close them down, so they only accept this particular religious group or this particular religious community or this particular political community's claims. The question is, how fast does that happen at the level of the brain? This is why I didn't understand, since I know nothing about the science.
How quickly
the science,
do
how quickly
we become Maoists?
How rapidly can we become Maoists?
Okay.
That's the, in
okay.
the sense, the point.
Well, without embarking on a course in neuroscience, basically, you're born with all the brain cells you'll ever have, but these connections are constantly shifting and changing to account for the growth of the brain after birth. And certainly at an early age, before the age of 10, where you have supernumerary connections, then you have lots of possibilities open to you. And what the brain does is to work not so much on a modular way, but with much more flexibility than later on.
Is that why you can learn languages?
That's right, and that's why, and you speak with an authentic accent before 10, whereas you don't afterwards. You know. So what happens is your brain is, you're born, lovely phrase, a citizen of the world. But then what happens is gradually, the price you pay for specialisation and being an individual is that you shut off one option as you embrace others. Yeah. So what happens is these connections are formed by repetition, by the arousal level, which releases chemicals, which help the connections to become stronger and stronger. And you can imagine, therefore, if you're in an environment where you're repeating something over and over again, and it could just be the times table, it doesn't have to be a madrasa or anything like this, then that is reflected in the strength of the relevant connections. So it happens over a childhood. It doesn't happen overnight. But connections are forming every sub-second, and they're changing the strength.
There is a suggestion here that this can't be unravelled.
Well, it's unravelled all the time. Think of the brain like a kaleidoscope, where every single moment it shifts and shifts and shifts. It's not that it's there and it's fixed and then you dismantle it. It's more constantly being modified and changed and reconfigured. All the time.
Elizabeth Pisani.
I'm interested in your two dimensions of the screen. Yeah. I'm not exactly a teenager, but I probably spend something like 6 hours a day looking at a screen. And I find that, in fact, you could think of it as a portal. In fact, it helps you make connections. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm very much of the text-based blogosphere, but I find that you can actually find new ideas and new connections that you don't necessarily find just from the books that would come your way if you were sitting in North London, you know, going to the library.
Because you're a person of the book, you presumably have read lots of books, you know what is meaningful to you. You have a conceptual framework. So therefore, if...
So there are different digital generations,
So therefore, you can ask a meaningful question and you can answer it. Whereas if you're a small child and you've been parked in front of a screen in an unsupervised way and you just press a button and things are flashed up and you press another button and things are flashed up, it's not the same.
Right. Well, let's move on to discuss... other forms of mass indoctrination, or at least mass belief. Anthony Paglen, a professor of political science and history at the University of California in Los Angeles. You have written a book called Worlds at War, which ranges right back to the earliest Greek narratives, Greeks versus barbarians, right up to Al-Qaeda today. And you present a world radically divided between East and West, or self-divided between East and West. I just wanted to start with some of the geography, because there are obvious large swathes of the world, Russia, China, which don't fit into this east-west pattern?
Well, they do and they don't. These are the two, but the Far East on the one hand and Russia on the other are complicated, except that Russia fits in or begins to fit in around about the 18th century quite easily. I mean, it's begin to be seen as part of the Western world. It sees itself as part of the Western world. It is, after all, Moscow concedes itself as the third Rome. So there's, and as it says, unlike the other two Romes, it will not fall. So there's a sense in which Russia takes over, certainly under Peter the Great, the burden of defending what they think of as a Western
against
culture,
the hordes
against
to the,
the hordes to the east. Now, it's true that there's a great deal of ambiguity in the West, what we traditionally think of the West, the European peninsula, about accepting these people. And, you know, I can give you all kinds of examples of people who speak at one moment as though they were part of Europe.
So the West is the European peninsula plus its American colony.
Yes. I mean, the word West comes into existence, and it was very difficult to juggling that when writing the book. The word West comes into existence, probably first used by Condorcet in the 18th century, who incidentally invented also all these large responses of the science of statistics, as precisely a way of embracing not only Europe, but Europe's overseas settler populations, that it was no longer possible to talk about Europe. However vaguely you might wish to define that, you had to include these settler populations overseas. So you have a much broader sense of what the West is, but it's still really Eurocentric. Right, the concept is a Eurocentric one. But Condorcet, of course, would also have included Russia in that.
There is a vast swathe here to encapsulate, and I apologise for the crudity of what I'm about to do, but in a sense your story says that the ancient Greek division between free city-states and some kind of democratic identity as against fawning Persian and other tyrannies to the east comes all the way through and can be in some sense related to the division of church and state and liberal democracy now versus versions of Islam which conflate spiritual and earthly authority and therefore are closer to the undemocratic system.
It comes all the way through, but I would insist that it comes all the way through as a series of self-overlapping self-perceptions.
Yes.
This is not an attempt to suggest that there's there is some sort of underlying reality, but it's not a clear development that it goes all the way from Greek isonomia, which isn't exactly speaking democracy, or even Athenian democracy, which isn't, despite attempts to make it out to seem so, isn't modern democracy either. But there is a continuity of perception. An important continuity of self-perception. And it's also, it's a continuity of self-perception largely confined to the West, I should say. That's the other thing.
I was going to say, or self-delusion, certainly at the time when the West, so-called, or the European states are incredibly brutal, barbarian, tyrannical, and primitive, and when, by contrast, the Muslim world is much more, in our terms, liberal and open to, for instance, Jews and other non-Muslims.
Yes, there are periods indeed. I mean, certainly in the Middle Ages, there is a period, let us say, round about the 12th and 13th century, where you have a flourishing Arab Muslim culture, which is in many respects, I wouldn't say all, but it's in many respects a great deal more open to, certainly to minorities within its midst than anything in the West is.
And in terms of illusion or delusion or the way we've seen ourselves, you argue that, for instance, the Crusades have been rather oversold, that they weren't as important at the time as they appear to be in retrospect.
In the time, no. I think that they were, as far as the peoples whom they were directed against, as I say, the swathe of land along the coast of the eastern Mediterranean, that area was one of constant turmoil and conflict at the time, and the Crusader armies seemed to be one incursion among many. They become increasingly important over time, and then it's really in the late 18th and 19th centuries that they become recycled as a crucial moment in a history of conflict. Mm. It's the statal moment, and it's particularly, of course, in the Muslim world that they come to be seen as that crucial moment of conflict.
I'm fast-forwarding ridiculously, but you end up
pretty close to the end of your narrative, talking about Qutb and the and Islamic thinkers who've affected the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and radical Islam today. And you're relatively dismissive about the Islamic view, which says actually this is only one tradition among many, that the fusion of authority of spiritual authority and earthly authority, which clearly is a problem for any liberal-minded democratic person, that is only one part of the tradition, and Muslims can be as enthusiastic democrats in a Western sense as anybody else.
Well, can I make one point? I don't deny that people can be, Muslims can be enthusiastic democrats, but in order to do that, they have to reject one part of this tradition, which seems to me crucial. Remember that Christianity is something grafted onto a massive state structure, the late Roman Empire, which has been a massive state structure in development for nearly, I mean, if you take the Greek past as well, for over 1,000 years. Islam is created out of a series of largely religious injunctions, injunctions about morals about how you should live your life. The state is created by the religion, not the other way around. Insofar as there is a state, it is created by the religion.
And yet, sorry, just to jump in, all the way through, Christianity has asserted its authority over secular issues, has fought back against that. I mean, even this week, there's going in Parliament here, there's a great debate about embryology and what is human, and the Church is heavily mobilising.
Well, that is true, but these are ethical issues. What it doesn't do, and this is the point I tried to stress again and again, is it doesn't interfere in the structure of the legal system, and never has done.
Susan,
I'm fascinated by this distinction of East and West, and again, forgive me if it's being oversimplifying it, to say that it's the conflation on the one hand of religion and government, and then democracy is separate. From, how would you view the states as they are headed at the moment, therefore? The most Western of Western democracies, but on the other hand, one that does seem to rely increasingly on religion.
Well, that is, I mean, it is a problem. But the day that the Supreme Court passes a law, right, which is based upon an interpretation of a sacred text, then you will have really serious difficulties. Mm-hmm. And so far, it hasn't done that. It might.
Do you think it might?
I mean, there's always that risk. I mean, I'm terrified that something like this will happen. But at the moment, that secular principle remains intact.
Jonathan Kent.
What I find interesting is how Islamic leaders see themselves as part of a historical perspective, whereas leaders in the West simply react to events. And I mean, the awful example is Bush after 9/11 referring to a crusade. But does this mean that there is a strength to Islamic leadership that we can never hope to match?
That perspective.
Yeah. Well, I think that strength actually is probably perspective and strength, but I think it's the wrong sort of strength in a sense. I mean, there's a great sensitivity to the historical past. I think it's much stronger. Now, this probably has a lot to do with, if you look at what the sensitivity is actually to, has a lot to do with the fact that these areas have been subjected to one form or another of colonialism for so long, and there is a resentment against the Western presence, and it's a perfectly legitimate and justified one. And so that this history is recycled as part of it, so to speak. So there's a much stronger sense of the historical continuity than you get in the West.
Yes.
It also has a lot to do with the way that these leaders are educated. Now, that history is just as fictional as the kind of history that you find in the United States. Now, Bush is a bad example because he seems to be astonishingly ignorant of most things. But if his advisors are not necessarily that, and they're conscious, for instance, like every schoolboy in the United States, enormously conscious of the structures that went for the founding of the Republic, that's the moment, the crucial moment that becomes important in their recycling history.
All right, well, let's move on to more war and culture clashes in a rather different setting. German-occupied Paris is the backdrop for Jonathan Kent's is directing this new musical, Marguerite, which has just opened at the Royal Haymarket in London. And, Jonathan, I should say it's a familiar story to the extent that it bears a close relationship to La Dame aux Camélias by Dumas and therefore Traviata and indeed Moulin Rouge. But you've set it at a time when Paris is particularly morally compromised. We talked on this programme a little while ago about Sartre and de Beauvoir, but there's all sorts of strange compromises being made.
Yeah, I mean, and it is, it's a period which the French are still extremely sensitive about, and a period of collaboration. But what it is, it is basically a great love story, as you say. It's based on La Dama Camelia. It's an iconic love story. You know, the whore is redeemed by love,
and the central figure here, she falls in love with she's the mistress of a German general.
She's being kept by a German general, and at her 40th birthday party, she meets and falls in love with a young jazz pianist with fatal results, and he's a member of the resistance. But what it does sets the love story in jeopardy. But it's also about a period in French history, which I think is as I said, still very sensitive. I mean, so much so that, for instance, the Maxwell Fools documentary, the Sorrow and the Pity, which was made in the late 60s, won an Oscar, was not shown on French television until the mid 80s, and it's still an area which is very sensitive.
And this is originally a French book and French music, which has come over. But there seem to have been some differences in terms of translating it. There's not too much of the sort of Nazi regalia and so on in your version.
No. I mean,
is that because we react in a strange way to seeing Jack
Boots? The English find, I don't know why, I find Nazis hilarious, which is not, and the danger is allo allo, which I hope we've avoided. But it is inevitably it's set against a terrible time in French history. But I think what is more interesting about it is the way that this relationship is played out against the background of war. And
pretty often you hear actors, actresses, directors say, there's too many musicals in the West End. What's interesting about this one is not just hugely lush production values and strong music, but you've got a quite a dark story in the middle of it. So a musical. What's the difference in your mind between a musical and some opera, for instance? Is it all really the same stuff, and it's snobbery that divides them?
Well, there is snobbery. There's snobbery about musicals, but it's a difficult form to calibrate the musical, especially a book musical, because opera.
Sorry, a book musical being as
a book musical, which means that it's not through sung,
right?
In the way that. Say, Phantom of the Opera, or there are certain types of through-sung musicals, or opera, obviously, which is obviously all sung. But it's a forcing together of two forms, a forcing together of straight theatre and music theatre, and it's to calibrate that is quite delicate, so that you move into music only when you can only that is the only way you can express yourself when dialogue won't carry the freight of the emotional burden
and many of us tend to think of musicals as being something sort of relatively light and frothy, but this is quite dark, isn't it? There's violent moments, certainly.
Yes, but it's not. But it is about love. It is about the redeeming power of love. It would be impossible to set it in that period without acknowledging the terrible nature of the times.
Elizabeth Pisani.
I think what's interesting about resetting this iconic story, as you say, in the years of the resistance and occupied France, is that it adds a layer of hypocrisy. So in the Dame aux Camélias, you have this hypocritical approach to prostitution. Someone can be feted as long as they're protected by a patron who is well-regarded in society. But it by adding this dimension of occupied France, you've got this whole other layer of hypocrisy, of these scummy profiteers, as they say on stage. The Otto, the Nazi general, is extraordinarily dismissive of Marguerite's friends, recognizing them for what they are, recognizing them for these disgusting profiteers who are just trying to be friends with Marguerite so that they can get petrol coupons from him. And I think it really puts a nice perspective on this hypocrisy that we already have around prostitution and how we deal with fallen women.
Right. But collaboration is interesting in that it's a very grey area. I grew up in South Africa during the apartheid years, and my parents were active politically, but within the constraints of those years. But in some ways, I suppose we were collaborating in a system. It's a grey area between survival and collaboration, and it's an interesting area.
Susan Greenfield.
Yeah, 2 points. One is just to pick back up on the idea that musicals have to be light and frothy. I think of Cabaret, for example, which dealt with very deep and dark themes of Nazism and was all the more successful for it.
Yeah.
And why I found it very interesting you set it in this era is the distinction between being just any old whore, and a collaborating whore, and that actually compounds it. And the fact that on top of that, even then, they could have, in some deep sense, an honour and behave in a way that was noble, I think makes all the more poignant, actually. So I think it was very clever of you to do that, because it does make, I say, very special that someone who's not just got loose morals to live, but has actually flown in the face of many things that one, in retrospect, despises, has nonetheless shown a great code.
Right.
OK, well, let's pick up then from the Wisdom of Whores, which is the title of Elizabeth Pisani's book. Elizabeth, journalist by background, but then you became, you worked for NGOs, and you became what you yourself describe as part of the AIDS mafia, going around researching, writing, propagandizing for money for AIDS programs and so on. Just tell us a little bit, first of all, about the kind of work that you were doing on the front line. Actually, you know, what kind of statistics were you compiling, and for what purpose and why?
Well, you read all the time in the papers, 33 million people infected with this fatal disease, 25 million already dead. And, of course, all of those numbers come from people who are out there in the field trying to, first of all, estimate the number of people in various risk groups and then the number of those people that might be infected. So I worked in Asia and in Latin America, and in fact in all of the world except for sub-Saharan Africa, HIV is largely confined to groups with definable risk behaviours, and those are people who buy and sell sex of all genders, by which I mean male, female and transgender, and people who inject drugs, and gay men who are in situations where they change partners a lot. So I spent a lot of time in sleazy nightclubs on the wrong side of town, the wrong side of many towns, actually setting up systems to take blood from people, but also to collect information about their risk behaviour so that we could plan our prevention programs better.
And that can never be easy, but has it become easier as people have understood more about AIDS? Because you're asking pretty intimate things of people who are presumably already nervous of authority in every way.
No, it hasn't become any easier. I think that, you know, when you read all the manuals about sexual behaviour research, and it all says, oh, be careful, you're asking sensitive questions, you have to remember that when you're talking to someone because they're a sex worker, as long as it's, or because they're a drug user, as long as it's established that they're a sex worker, actually, it's not a very sensitive question for them. It's just like asking, it's a work-a-day thing. I say in the book, I think that it's like asking a plumber how many leaks he's fixed in the last week. How many people have you slept with? Well, it's just part of your work life, and people are actually quite happy to talk about it.
But you argue that the statistics were sort of massaged or spun for initially noble reasons, or perhaps even now for noble reasons. Explain how that happened.
Well, I think that very early on, when it became apparent that in most of the world HIV was not going to rage through the general population, that was going to stay confined largely within these groups, which are, you know, sex workers and clients, drug injectors and gay guys, that we had to do something to put those on the political agenda. Because let's face it, there's not a lot of votes in doing nice things for drug injectors. And so we were trying to find a way to make people care about these risk groups. And the way we did that was to say, if we don't do the right thing for these groups, then it might become a bigger problem in the general population. Unfortunately, in my opinion, this has rather backfired, because although it did bring the money rolling in, that was great, people, instead of getting the "if we don't do the right thing for these groups" part of the message, got the "oh my goodness, it's innocent women and children that are going to be threatened" part of the message. And so they invested the money in the wrong place. Instead of investing it in programs for giving clean needles for drug injectors, they invested it in programs for pregnant women and school children.
And part of the result has been that for an awful lot of people, AIDS has disappeared almost entirely off their radar as an issue. They think they're now convinced that it's an issue for other people, small groups of people. They perhaps feel that they were sold the wrong story initially, and there's a sort of complacency that anyway it's sort of been cured now, hasn't it?
Well, those are two separate things.
Yeah.
The "it's not my problem" and the "it's been cured now" are both...
Well, let's take them one after another.
Okay.
The "it's not my problem."
"It's not my problem" thing. The truth is, you know, and I will never work again for saying this, but the truth is that for most people, it's not your problem. It's true. I would say that if, in the same way that I'm not a smoker, but that doesn't mean that I don't think that we should be doing research on lung cancer. The fact is that all of us, most of us like sex. Many of us like to get high in one way or another, whether through alcohol or drugs or whatever. These are behaviors that are part of human identity, part of human frailty. And even if you don't engage in them yourself, you have to recognize that your son might, your husband might, you know, or your yoga teacher might. And therefore, we need to be investing in programs to make these things safer.
And if, I mean, the other part of this, "it's not my fault," it's not my problem issue, presumably there are cultural problems sometimes about facing up to, for instance, why there is so much AIDS in Southern Africa. People don't like to speak about the fact that there's just a tradition or a culture of lots and lots of sexual partners, both genders.
I wouldn't say lots and lots, but you're right. Sexual patterns of sexual networking are very different. The thing is not actually about raw numbers. The thing is about how many people you have at any one time. And because of really a history that of polygamy, which goes back many, many, many centuries, way before colonialism or whatever, it's more common in Africa for both men and women to have more than one partner simultaneously. And because HIV is not very infectious, but actually is only infectious for a very short space of time when you're first infected, and then only much later on when your immune system begins to deteriorate, it means that if you have two or three partners at any one time in those first three or four very infectious months, you're more likely to pass it on than if you have a huge number of partners, but you only have them one after another, because by the time you move on to your next partner, you're probably not infectious anymore.
Which is why it's so much more of a problem in parts of Southern Africa
exactly.
than in other parts of the world. Last question from me, that my point about people think, well, it's on the way to being cured anyway.
Well, that is true in certainly in the industrialized world. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is that HIV new infections are not falling, and in some cases they're actively rising. What happens, of course, when you increase treatment is that you increase the number of people with HIV because people aren't dying. So more treatment means more people infected, which means more people who can pass on the infection. Now, treatment does reduce the likelihood that you'll pass on the infection, but equally, risk is going through the roof. So even communities such as gay men in this country, who have had very good prevention successes and have established new norms of condom use, are actually beginning to get a bit slack again. And so we're seeing new infections rise, and that's a problem.
Anthony.
I just want to ask one other thing which you haven't mentioned so far, which you do mention in your book, which is the question of misappropriation of funds, i.e. corruption at local levels. I mean, how much of this is how much of the money that's going out from World Aid organisations is actually making its way into the field?
A lot of it's making its way into the field. Not very much of it is making its way into the places where it would actually make a difference to the transmission of HIV. So it's getting out there, but it's being spent on the wrong things.
Susan Greenfield.
And given that, what's the attitude of people in the gay community or the drug culture community? Do they feel that they could be having more treatment and more resources spent on them, but through this scenario that you described. Are they angry, or how do they feel about it?
I think in developing countries where there's very, very little being done, for example, for drug injectors, yes, there's a certain amount of anger. People just wish that it was easier to get a clean needle and can't understand why you're putting billions into programs for school kids. In the developed world, people have just zoned it out pretty much. And so you hear even people who are most at risk saying, oh, well, HIV, it's kind of like diabetes these days, isn't it? You know, you say that to your mate who's got diabetes and it's like, oh, I wouldn't wish this on anyone. But there is a sort of zoning out of the whole problem.
Jonathan Kent.
I'm interested why South Africa is in such denial, particularly Mbeki is in such denial about HIV/AIDS being a sexually transmitted disease and insisting that it is really a function of poverty and malnutrition. Why do you think that is? I mean, it's...
It is such a mystery to me and to everyone else, I think. I mean, the only thing that one can say is that with the peculiar history of apartheid in South Africa, which you know very well, I think that there was a deliberate attempt to portray black South Africans as savages somehow, and there was this whole hypersexualization, they call it, of the African male.
But, you know, by white
supremacists. So it was like, you know, be careful, lock up your white women because they're all going to be raped by black men. And I think that his denial is specifically a rejection of that. Unfortunately, the result is that, you know, one in three...
Catastrophic.
Yeah. One in three... South African adults are infected with a fatal preventable disease. I would have thought that he would be grown up enough to be doing something about
that. The
trouble
is that Zuma, who's looking to take over, is even worse. He thinks if you have a shower after having unprotected sex, you're going to be okay.
Our message to all listeners is that that's not true. All right, thank you to all my guests today. Elizabeth Pisani's book, The Wisdom of Whores, Susan Greenfield's ID, The Quest for Identity in the 21st Century, and Anthony Pagden's book, Worlds at War, are all out now. Jonathan Kent's new musical, Marguerite, is on at the Theatre Royal in London's Haymarket until November. Next week, John McCain's foreign policy adviser, Robert Kagan, on The Return of History, and that's in a bad way, I should say. The novelist, Andrew O'Hagan, on Our Enjoyment of Celebrity Suffering and much else. Helen Rappaport on The End of the Romanoffs, and Neil Labute on his new play, Fat Pig. But for now, thank you and goodbye.